Good day, and welcome to the Kaiser Family Foundation's webcast series, U.S. Global Health Policy in Focus. We're coming to you live from our broadcast studio in Washington, D.C. I'm Jen Cates, Vice President at the Kaiser Family Foundation. In Focus brings you discussions and takes your questions about current issues and debates concerning the U.S. government's role in global health as a donor, partner, implementer, and often world agenda setter. Each program features leaders in their fields who share their views and experiences with us. Today, we are very pleased to have an expert panel to discuss the Institute of Medicine's new report released just yesterday, addressing the case for deeper involvement in global health by the U.S. The report includes specific recommendations pertaining to the U.S. government, academia, the private sector, civil society, and others. Over the next hour, we'll discuss the report, delving into some of the findings, particularly in light of the Obama administration's recent announcement of a new global health initiative. Today's conversation is live and interactive, and we encourage you to submit questions now or as we go along. You can email your questions to infocus@kff.org. Please send them in. I'll be monitoring them during the show. I would now like to introduce our guests, who are each members of the IOM's Committee on the U.S. Commitment to Global Health, the independent committee that authored the report. We had also hoped to have Gail Smith, Special Assistant to the President and Senior Director at the National Security Council, with us, but she was unable to attend at the last minute due to other meetings. So today we have Ruth Levine, who is a Vice President and Senior Fellow at the Center for Global Development, Jeffrey Copeland, the Vice President of Global Health and Director of the Global Health Institute at Emory University, and Maria Frere, the President of the Albert and Mary Lasker Foundation. Thanks to all of you for being here. We hope to have a candid conversation today about the new report and its implications for the U.S. government's engagement in global health. Again, to our audience, you can email us questions during this webcast. Send them to infocus@kff.org. Hi, everyone. Ruth, I'd like to start with you to give us the big picture on the report, why it was done now, what its main findings were. But I actually want to start with something that you just posted on the CGD blog, because I think it sums up for everybody in Twitter fashion. In fact, you said if there were a Twitter version of this report, here's what it would be. So in 140 word characters or less, Ruth says, "Thanks for a good decade. Don't slack off now. $15 billion by 2012. Healthier world equals happier, healthier us. It's more than AIDS. Plays nice with others. Get your act together." So that we're going to continue for the next hour, though, and having read the report and been at the release yesterday and heard some of the issues that came up, I know that the committee grappled with some really tough things. Take us there and let us know what the report was about, why now, and how it related to what was done in December.
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about this report. I know that I'm proud of how it turned out and really enjoyed the opportunity to work with the co-chairs, Harold Varmus and Ambassador Thomas Pickering, the IOM staff, and my fellow committee members. We tussled and debated a lot of issues, and I think in the end, the final result really represents a genuine consensus view of some priority areas in which the U.S. really needs to make some key contributions to better health around the world. So maybe I could just take a couple of minutes and talk about first, the motivation for the report. About 10 years ago, the IOM produced a seminal report called America's Vital Interest, or In America's Vital Interest, which really laid out the case in both humanitarian and particularly enlightened self-interest terms for greater investment and involvement by the United States in health in developing countries. And so this was now a dozen years later, really a moment to look at what's happened, which has been a tremendous growth in both resources and activities and successes, and also look ahead at a moment when the U.S. administration is making transitioned. Out of the work that we did, there are sort of five key messages. So I'm just going to ask for more details, but I'll just go over them really very briefly. So the first is to fulfill commitments already made and invest in scaling up in areas where we are quite far from achieving the Millennium Development Goals. So in areas of maternal and child health, for example, there's just far more to be done with existing interventions and approaches. And we also within this recognize the really significant emerging burden of disease in non-communicable areas, chronic diseases. So that's sort of number one. Number two was recognizing the tremendous assets that the U.S. has to bring to bear in knowledge generation, in scientific research, to put additional focus on deploying those for the benefit of health in other countries. So that ranges from biomedical research at the National Institutes of Health to investments in better impact evaluation to make aid dollars more effective. Mm-hmm. Third area is quite a strong message, I think, in the report about the importance of long-term commitments to institutional development in developing countries, not just one-off short-term programs, and a recognition of the importance of the U.S. making a commitment to support the development of human resources, which is, as you know, a real constraint. And we call for an increase in U.S. financial commitments through the development assistance budget to global health, ramping up to about $15 billion by 2012. And then finally, we focus quite a bit on the importance of the U.S. engaging with developing countries in a fully respectful way around national health plans that are genuinely country-developed and country-owned, and engaging in respectful partnerships with in the international community, particularly with the World Health Organization. We have some specific recommendations there.
Okay. Before we get into some of those specifics more in-depth, one of the things that I know the committee must have grappled with and came up yesterday, some of us were at the release of the big report, how the committee defined global health. This is clearly a challenge. There's no one definition. And Jeff, would you share with us sort of how the committee approached that, what was in, what was out, and how what were the boundaries that you put on that concept?
Thanks, Jen. Global health is used in two ways in the report, and I think the overriding and the beginning of the report emphasizes it's an aspiration, it's a goal. We pursue good health for the global population, a pursuit of global health. And that's used as the motivational background for the report as a whole and recommendations in it. But there's also a field of global health that many of us identify with as the area in which we work. Departments and schools are named this. People say that they're working in global health. And so while the goal is still there, it's also a field of study and research, advocacy, practice, if you will. And for that, it's really a term that's evolved out of international health and to some degree tropical medicine and hygiene before that. It overlaps with these areas. It overlaps with public health. And the overlap is large, but when folks talk about global health nowadays, it's largely around a pursuit of improving health and health equity around the world. It involves multidisciplinary and interdisciplinary work to a degree that was probably not true 10, certainly 20, 50 years ago. Involves a true partnership relation with the countries with whom one is working. We learn, they learn, we offer things, they offer things, we both benefit. So it's a mutually beneficial interchange, symbiotic, if you will. And it's these elements that, when put together, constitutes what most of us are thinking about in global health. Having said that, there are thousands of practitioners, and I'm sure lots of people will say, I've got a different definition that's better. But I think those elements are part of most people's definition.
And just to push you a little bit more on that or get more information, I know that infectious diseases was part of that. I know that chronic disease was part of that. And some of the more traditional things that people think of when they think of health. What about things like clean water and food aid that could be for nutrition purposes? Were those included in your discussions? Were they part of the definition?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Global health is much, much broader than even those mm-hmm. things. Mm-hmm. So certainly water and sanitation, mental health issues, injury prevention and control, but also the socioeconomic determinants mm-hmm. of health. The position of women, women's education in developing countries, other welfare systems, education as a whole, infrastructure issues in a country all play a role in health.
Okay. And we'll come back to that probably when we talk about the financial commitment issue, because costing those out, I know, is challenging to figure out. I actually wanted to pick up on something Ruth said around the 1997 report, because I know that was a seminal piece, and a lot of us working in the field have used that report, and now we have a new one to use. I know a lot has happened since then. Maria, would you maybe bring us back a little bit and then up to date as to what changed, what has changed, what's different now, and maybe some things that might not have changed as much as we would hope?
Well, as Ruth said earlier, a remarkable number of things have changed, and it's very, very exciting. We now have a momentum, I believe, in global health that we simply didn't have 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. Most people weren't aware of the existence of global health, and you see a remarkable change in attitude, people's attitude. We're a globalized community, a globalized world. Something happens in another part of the world, and we see it immediately in our television sets. You know, the swine flu being a case in point. We are very sensitive to the issues of health globally and around the world. That translates directly into excitement on our campuses, for example. We see a new generation of students that are really very interested in these issues. They've come to me, I'm sure they've come to other members of the panel, say, how can we help? Where can we go? What can we do? There has been an enormous change in the philanthropic landscape. Large foundations like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, for example, have come to the fore and helped us with the financing and in identifying new ways of supporting the importance of global health globally. And frankly, new ways of doing business. We didn't have the funding mechanisms that we have now, like the Global Fund, or even Gavi. And we didn't have the product development partnerships, new sense of can-do attitude, of people getting together using the best vehicles, the best way of developing a new drug or developing a new vaccine for markets for which there really is no money to be made. And so you find partners in industry, with partners in academia, with people in these product development groups that are focused on developing new drugs, new vaccines, new diagnostics for a population that had been very much neglected. So it's a different place where we were in 1997. Now, what hasn't changed? Well, a lot hasn't changed. The amount of money that we're spending for this, and as important as health is in this country, I think we have to understand that the amount of money that this country spends in global health, although it has increased enormously, we came from a very, very small base. So it's still, if you have a pie chart, it's still like a
it's
hair.
Less than 1%.
It's a hair on the the pie chart if you want to identify it. So we have to look into that. What hasn't changed, I also think, is our ability to tap the brightest and the best at the countries, and we should enhance the infrastructure in those countries and ensure that they have the wherewithal and the ability to, in fact, do some of the research and some of the activities in their health system, was mentioned earlier. I think that's incredibly important. So we still have a ways to go, and I think that's where this group focused, and that's where we want to take it. So where have we been? We've come a long way. What did your blog say? We've come a long way.
Thanks for a good decade. Don't slack off now.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's go to the political environment, because I think a lot that has changed has been around attention at the foreign policy level. One of the things that is of interest to me, too, is that you came out with a letter report in December. And in that letter report, there was a recommendation made for a White House, high-level White House engagement in global health. This was December, before the new administration. I don't know if this is a record in history of an IOM report coming out in December, and by January or February, there was that particular recommendation had begun to be implemented. Can you talk a little bit about what the intention and the timing was for that December report, and what you've seen with what the White House has already done, and more that could be done? And then we'll get to this White House role, which I'll probably, Jeff, if you want to take this one, please do.
The committee recognized, and the chairs in particular recognized, that the timing of the report was coming at the same time as an administration change was taking place. And so even before it was clear who that administration would be, the idea was, well, let's get some background material in front of people as they begin to formulate what they're going to do in their new administration. It's a time when lots of policies are being discussed, and it would seem a shame to have our report come out 6 months later at a time when some things had already been put in the works. So that was the idea of a December letter, and we're pleased to have gotten it out quickly and in a succinct form and with a lot of the ideas that you see in the finished report. The discussion of the interagency aspects of this subject have been in part the evolution of global health, and at one period it would have been seen as just a niche in health, or maybe a something that would be a passing phrase in foreign policy discussions. But as we've all seen, in every place you go, health is seen as an element of diplomacy, security, economic development, a range of issues, and that's increasingly recognized in other departments of government. So the idea was to bring the discussion so that you had interplay of Department of State, Department of Health and Human Services, Treasury where appropriate. Foreign trade is an issue in this. It interrelates to educational issues and just a range of important policies, both domestic and international. And so where could you best put that together? And there was active discussion amongst the committee as to where that might go. Should one particular department, cabinet department, have it and then try to bring the others in? Is it better to move it up to a higher level where it can have interplay more directly with the Office of Management and Budget and the National Security Council? And the end, I think, conclusion was to elevate it to a place where it has access to key decision makers and power brokers, if you will, and people with resources, and permit it to be not the property of just one department was valuable, and proximity to the National Security Council that makes important decisions on a global front for the U.S. Was also seen as desirable.
So what was the argument for, or the discussion around maybe keeping it at a department level versus in the White House? Were there some opinions about why that might be beneficial? I mean, just as I think all of us are looking to see how this gets put in place, and from our understanding, it is a White House interagency committee or task force that's been set up that is very much being pushed and led by the National Security Council. There are potentially other, with OMB and other partners in departments, but one could say, what's the role of departments in that? So is there discussion around?
Well, a couple of concerns expressed by some, and I guess expressed by me, so it's appropriate that I'll raise them here, include that there is a huge resource of skill, expertise, and experience in health in the Department of Health and Human Services, so that one would want to avoid trying to duplicate that in other departments between NIH, CDC, FDA, et cetera. There's a lot of people who've done a lot of work in this, and you can't. It would be inefficient for government to try to duplicate those in other departments in order to keep this going. So that's a concern. I don't think it undermines the proposal and the recommendation made, but we really should still use those key players and the range of their resources in doing global health. And another concern is what being part of or near or having a person sitting in the National Security Council means globally. For many of us working in public health internationally for a number of years, anything that links to the word security is not a good thing in the sense of its tie-in to intelligence agencies and all that. Mm-hmm. So there just needs to be sensitivity to that part of it, that our goal was certainly had nothing to do with that. It had to do with proximity to decision makers and a place where you bring together many different parts of the government at a high level, and that was the reason for the recommendation. At the same time, I think we need to be sensitive as we work with other countries about their concerns about who are our partners in this.
Actually, one question to put out to all of you about that picks up on that a little bit. If you look at the U.S. response and how the U.S. has organized its global health scale-up, let's say, in the last 10 years, it's been largely in the foreign policy realm in terms of where the finances are and some of the major programs are run out of, with, of course, HHS and its divisions as part of that. There seem to potentially be risks and benefits to that arrangement. I mean, you get the foreign policy role in the world and the missions that USAID and State Department oversee, but you have the health expertise at CDC with epidemiologists. Does anyone want to talk to that? It's something that's been identified as both a strength of having both perspectives, but could also lead to some challenges.
All right, I'll take that. I think it is a genuine concern. And for the people representing each agency, for example, if you have an interagency group, mm-hmm. They have to be true to their responsibilities for that agency. Each agency and each group has a mission and a responsibility. And they do see the elephants sort of touch it, at, you know, like the blind men in different places, because that is what their authorities are about. So the idea here is that this interagency group, and in particular having a very wise and thoughtful chair, is able to put all the pieces of the elephant together so that it's seen. Another way to look at it is from the perspective of the country. So if you have different agencies that have different requirements because of their authorities and their needs, you end up with the best of intentions completely overwhelming a group that's trying to be responsive to your needs. So if you're at HHS or at CDC, you may have one series of issues. If you are part of the trade groups, you have other kinds of issues. And so it becomes quite burdensome to the country, even though we're supporting them. Perhaps not as much as we should, but in many cases, in with the best of intentions, you end up drowning the country in just their ability to respond to the individual needs. So the idea here was to have a group that understood this, that understood the complexity and what we were asking countries to do, and to release some of the stress of the countries and put it much more into getting things done than getting things reported necessarily in different ways to different people. So if we could streamline that, we thought it would be very beneficial.
Okay. Maybe I could just add that this is, you know, very consistent sort of in microcosm with the debates that are going on about development assistance and engagement in the development enterprise more generally. And, you know, I think there's a pretty strong consensus view among a sort of consortium of research groups, implementers, and so forth who work in development, that there needs to be a kind of national strategy that is across government related to, you know, how to engage with the problems of development with developing countries, and that has to be, in some sense, above the level of individual agencies.
A point to bring up in the report, we also not only suggest that we have this group or this individual to focus on these issues at a very, very high level, but we also call for a committee of outsiders, so to speak, for lack of a better term, to look at what's being done and to be able to advise. So there, people are not talking amongst themselves, but that there's a group out there that they can tap and bounce things off. And so there's two parts to that recommendation.
So a non-governmental committee or advisory
of advisory
sorts.
Group, yeah.
Okay, that would advise it. Well, let's get to, speaking of elephants, I'm sure that we've gotten some questions about this around the money recommendation, the investment that was recommended by the report, which was $15 billion by 2012. I'm sure that was sort of being developed while the administration was putting out its budget request, which was a little over $8 billion for fiscal year 2010. That seems like hard to see how it would get from 8 to 15. Can you talk a little bit about what went into thinking on that number? Was it an aspirational, let's hope we can get there? Was it based on looking at MDGs, looking at actual costing of things? How did that get to be the consensus recommendation?
Well, there, you know, this is something that we had
any number of discussions about, as you can imagine. And there's no perfect way to come up with this number, because in some sense the needs are always going to exceed the capacity of any individual or even collection of external funders to provide the resources. So I'll just give a flavor of what the considerations were. We tried to get to something that was a combination of ambitious, the don't slack off part, and realistic, recognizing that we're one of many players, including a very much developing country governments and other institutions in country themselves, and recognizing that we are, you know, very much in financial straits these days, and so it's simply not realistic to shoot for the moon. At the same time, there are international norms and practices that other OECD countries have established and are adhering to about how much of their national resources are devoted to development assistance broadly, and then what share of that is being devoted to health. And so when you sort of look at international standards, you come close to a target of $15 billion. Just one more factor is that that would also permit us to largely fulfill commitments that have already been made and really must be fulfilled under PEPFAR. Plus balance some of that commitment with additional resources for, as I said, maternal and child health, family planning, and some of the areas that really haven't gotten much funding at all, and certainly not much growth in the past 8 years or so. And then devote about $2 billion to this emerging issue of chronic diseases, which account in some countries for, you know, up to half of the burden of disease, and it's only going to grow.
I want to get to that issue of balancing the portfolio, because that was one that was recommended in the report. It was addressed. It's definitely one that's probably easier to write than to do. And so how did you – I'm sure there were some discussions about that too. How do you grapple with that if you're now trying to implement those recommendations, for example, if one were, the government was trying to? How does – some say it's a zero-sum game, particularly with tight economic – time. So this is a concern that's come up. We had a discussion last week about the budget, and this was a big issue. So what would be some discussions and thoughts that went into that? How would there be a rebalancing? Is it really about proposing an increase that would then allow for maintaining plus? I don't know if anyone wants to take that or talk. How do you go about balancing the portfolio?
Well, balancing means a couple of things here. There's a lot of balance issues in the report. It doesn't mean a balance of 50-50, right, but it's putting things in some better proportion to each other. And one of them is the application of what we know and the need for new knowledge. And so those are two things that are emphasized in the report. I personally would reject this idea that it's a zero-sum game. It oughtn't to be a zero-sum game. For our personal care, if we went to a doctor or a hospital and said, you know, we'll take care of your heart and we'll do the cardiology stuff, but, you know, you just don't qualify for neurology. We're not doing that today for you, and we're not going to do GI. We'll do a little bit of this other thing. You'd say, what, are you crazy? You know, we have a range of health issues personally that we need attended to, and we want them attended to. And so to pick certain diseases, which as compelling as they are and as worthy of investment, and then ignore some others, to me doesn't make any sense. If someone's going to die young in another country, you don't want that to happen, and we need to take what steps we can to address it. And that's some of the balancing that you see in the report. We in no way wish to, and it was never suggested by anyone at any time, to do anything but increase the activities going on in PEPFARs for HIV/AIDS, in malaria, and in TB, all extraordinarily important health issues for many parts of the world, and pressing and compelling ones. By the same token, the largest cause of death in youngsters in some Asian countries is injuries. Mm-hmm. There's an untouched burden for mental illness in these places, and there are simple things that could be done that would be helpful for it. There are the chronic diseases and the risk factors for them are communicated disease. These are diseases that the West communicates to developing countries. Smoke, you're more glamorous. Eat these foods, you're going to enjoy them, that are high in calories, high in fat, and high in salt. And so these are areas that the committee has recognized are not just problems in the distant future, these are problems right now in these countries. 80% of the burden from chronic diseases is going to be shortly in poor and middle-income countries. There'll be 1 billion deaths this century from tobacco use, and the biggest burden is going to be in poor and middle-income countries. So we can't ignore these things. So our view is that this seems like a big investment, but it is modest, really minuscule compared to lots of other things that we put our money into. And so we didn't get into the other things we should take it from. But as we know, every day in reading the papers, sums of this kind are being used for lots of other things that we think are of less public good than what we're proposing.
I think it's also very important to appreciate that the committee did reflect on the amount of money and the need of this country. We were very sensitive, as we've been talking about balances, of understanding that there are issues in this country that we have to address as well, which, interestingly enough, form part of global health. And so when we were looking at balance, we were not only looking at the needs of this country, and of course we're not insensitive to those, but our focus really was on the low and middle income countries for this particular report. So we weren't insensitive to the needs here. We were specifically focused on the needs of the low and middle income countries. And as Jeff said, a lot of the diseases that we have here today are the diseases that they're having, and the number of deaths from those are enormous. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing a globalized world and more of a disease understanding of the world as a unit, which I think is important.
Okay. Let me just chime in with one more. I like the way you frame the different types of balance, and I think one additional kind of balance is between mobilizing more money and using it as more effectively or as effectively as possible. And so I think you'll see chapters or sections in the report that really try to make that distinction and demonstrate that there's room for improvement in how we use development assistance dollars to achieve health goals, whether it's by focusing more attention within the PEPFAR context on prevention, or whether it's using performance incentives in particular health programs to use aid money to improve the performance of health systems, or whether it's, you know, different ways to apply knowledge that we have to make the programs work more effectively.
Okay. The one piece that I think we have to be clear on the $15 billion is that the research, for example, basic science research, mm-hmm. et cetera, is not included in that piece. And I think the committee feels that that's fundamentally critical to ensure that we, first of all, we're leaders in the world in that realm. And if there's something that we can bring to the table is our ability to generate knowledge, to come up with knowledge that helps us broadly, helps us here, helps us abroad. But let's make very clear that that $15 billion by 2012, which seems to be the mantra today, does not include money for that.
I actually want to turn to a question that came in that picks up on that a little bit. It's from Jennifer Chow at Research America, and she asks, we know that the U.S. benefits from the knowledge gained through global health research. How much consideration did the committee give to these benefits to Americans when putting together this report? What do the report findings mean for global health research funding, specifically at agencies like NIH and CDC? So funding wasn't included, but it was certainly the role
Absolutely.
Of those. Yeah, I don't know if you want to talk about the recommendations or discussions around research and how we deploy our knowledge, for example.
Maybe it would be good to put some specific, you know, faces and disease faces and health issue faces on the discussion. There are things right now that we can apply that we know and that are very effective. We need to do more on measles vaccine would be a good example that. There shouldn't be children dying of measles in the world. We should be able to address the 1 billion people that don't have potable water, the 2.5 billion that don't have adequate sanitation with existing technologies, but improved technologies would go a long way towards helping us do that, whether it's in sanitation, whether it's improved water supplies at a village level, at a rural dry area, and the different various ecological systems in which water is inadequate. TB, which is a concern for all of us, whether we travel, whether we have our prey to it here, it still exists in all of our cities and throughout the country. The treatments we have for it are few, slow, and really inadequate for the task at hand. We need more of them. We need better ones. We need better diagnostic approaches to that. So while that has a huge impact globally in countries throughout the world, it has a big impact here and will affect the health of Americans. And this is true for virtually all the things that we're talking about. Now, some of them have much higher incidence and prevalence rates in subtropical Africa. But we travel a lot. Our children travel. People from there are coming here. And that's not going to change, and it shouldn't. It's an improvement in the world for us to move about and be exposed, be educated, have others come here. And once that happens, we need to be prepared with diagnosis, treatment, preventive techniques, and we need research for that.
One of the, I think, the best example or one of the most exciting examples of people in this country were galvanized by the Human Genome Project. Mm-hmm. And it was a massive, massive effort that was started here, but it certainly had partners all over the world in the UK and Japan, etc. And people really, it caught the world's attention. There was Time magazine covers, you know, Science magazine covers, etc. As a result of that investment, we are now able to look for the genomes of some of the parasites, the bacteria, the viruses that affect us globally. So research that was focused on one end has an enormous impact for our ability, for example, to design new tuberculosis mm-hmm. drugs. The more we know about the bacillus, the more focused we are in developing a potential diagnostics, a potential therapy. So the investment that we make in basic research really has an enormous multiplier effect that has benefit for us, for the population here, and the population abroad. And I think that's critically important.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back to your balance thing, yep. one of the points raised in the report is, just as Maria has said, that the research needs to start at basic, and there's a tremendous value in applying those in other research. Then how do you translate that genomic work into more research that then moves us into therapies that are effective? But also the report emphasizes policy research, evaluation Absolutely. Research, epidemiologic research, which is how do we make these programs work better when they're in the field? How do we get them applied in a way that's efficient, cost-effective? And these are big issues. As Ruth said, we need to be better at delivering what we deliver now and do it in a better way with outcomes that are measured.
Mary Lasker had a wonderful saying. She used to say, if you think research is expensive, try disease. So, it is true.
Actually, going back to the $15 billion, and just so people understand what was contained in that, is it didn't have research, but for scaling up or doing more on the chronic disease side, because we had a couple questions come in around the chronic diseases, which you all addressed as being very important to what the committee was taking on. We have a question from Rennie Sloan, for example, at the American Cancer Society, asking about cancer as a leading cause of death and chronic diseases.
Absolutely.
That was part of the costing as well in your analysis?
Yeah, I mean, to be candid, we can't properly say that we did, bottom-up costing. And had we, it would have, again, to be candid, been a really scary number, because the burden of chronic disease is rising. I think our current technologies and approaches, which are more focused on cure than on prevention, it's a big ticket item that we'd be talking about. And I think there are real questions about what the role is of external public dollars in addressing those. So really what we put into the ask, if you will, is a symbol, an important symbol, and a substantive one,
a placeholder.
That's a better term that says, look, this is an emerging area that needs attention, And there is a role for U.S. development assistance to make a difference. It was by no means sort of costing of what it's going to take, because that's going to be something else altogether.
But to put an addendum on Ruth's comment, we have had prevention successes even for the chronic non-communicable diseases. So hepatitis B vaccine, a product of the research effort that Maria refers to, is widely used throughout the world, and it directly addresses chronic hepatic cirrhosis and carcinoma of the liver. In addition, we have a new human papillomavirus vaccine, which, if more widely used, will have a huge impact on cervical cancer throughout the world and cervical cancer deaths. Tobacco use. We've got a very simple technology for decreasing tobacco use. Raise taxes, amongst other things. And it's been effective everywhere it's been done, and we can work towards those ends. Decrease of 50% of mortality in America for cardiovascular disease deaths, mortality, in the last couple of decades is due to a mixture, it's probably 50-50 components of balance, if you will, of preventive approaches, attention to diet, cholesterol, decreasing tobacco use, etc., and curative and diagnostic approaches of intensive care units, speed of getting people to the hospital, etc., and medication. So there's a lot we can do and have impact on those things.
I want to go back to picking up on what you said in the question we got from Research America about the benefits here. Mm-hmm. One of the things that happened over the last 10 years is the emergence of countries that have a remarkable capability of understanding. They do great basic research. They're going to continue to grow. I'm talking about countries like Brazil, China, India, etc., where these diseases are prevalent and they're growing. And so it is not inconceivable, and in fact it's probably quite possible, that we will learn from them, from their experiences, from their studies, and that will inform what we are able to do and what we're able to move forward. So it really is very important to ensure that we have the right communications and that our knowledge is communicated freely and openly, and that scientists worldwide can tap the information so that they can make good judgments for their populations as well as for the scientific community.
So actually, I want to go to the Twitter synopsis again, because I think it's helping us frame all this. The play nice with others part of this. That was a big focus of the report's recommendations, particularly centering on the role of the WHO, but not just the WHO and not just other donors. But let's hear more about that. What was the feeling there, and what were some of the recommendation specifics around that?
Well, I think, you know, it's not a secret that the past 8 years have brought really tremendous commitment and success, unprecedented, from the U.S. side in global health, particularly and primarily with respect to PEPFAR. At the same time, there has been, you know, an eight-year period when most of the action by far has been bilateral, and not really sort of the kind of engagement with multilateral institutions and particularly UN agencies that many in global health would like to see, and certainly are, you know, the donors in Europe and elsewhere have been really asking for. So kind of in the spirit of the transition that's occurred in the U.S., I think there's a real opening for just a change in the relationship and a use of the U.S. Asset of global leadership and engagement with whether it's the World Bank, the World Health Organization, the Global Fund, Global Alliance for Vaccines and Immunization, or any number of the many other organizations that are out there. In terms of the specifics, one that we focused quite a bit on was really taking a close look at the World Health Organization, the relationship between the U.S. and the World Health Organization, from the amount of money that we contribute through dues and voluntary contributions to the way that the U.S. affects and is affected by WHO policies. Really taking a close look at that, thinking that through. And in that context, we encourage the U.S. to step up its game in terms of financial resources to WHO. But within the spirit of making that organization as effective as it needs to be to tackle everything from H1N1 to chronic disease prevention.
Yeah.
Far be it for me to try to explain Ruth's play well with Twitter. Others through your
ahead,
Twitter phrase.
Ahead. Go ahead.
I thought maybe you were talking about the committee interaction.
Yeah.
We did well.
It
also applies at a kind of an interpersonal level as well. The nature, if one goes back over the last 100 years of people working in other countries, you begin in a colonial era, mm-hmm. Where truth and knowledge was being brought from one place to another. And that hasn't worked for a long time, nor should it. And I think one of the things the report emphasizes, and Ruth said it well in terms of agencies and system structures, but it's also the attitude that we bring to working with other people. We aren't bringing truth and knowledge. We're bringing our experience and some expertise to be shared with other people's experience and expertise, and together try to solve problems together. Problems that are going to benefit us as much or as more as they're going to benefit them. And I think that spirit of real partnership is an extremely important element of global health today. And without it, you're going to make no progress.
The committee also, when talking about WHO, for example, says, and you touched on this, step up the involvement there, but evaluate it. And
yes.
What were some of the things that came up around that and the need to take a look at WHO as well as support that institution?
Well, I think there are, this could be a whole other program
to
talk about,
right?
To talk about, sort of how WHO works and where it's perhaps not yet fully achieving its potential. But just to give you a flavor of some of the issues that we talked about, WHO is pretty thinly spread across a very large number of priorities. Many of those shaped by the interests of specific financial contributors through voluntary contributions. And so because of that, there's a bit of a fragmentation of the WHO efforts. And so I think part of, any close look would be to sort of, really look at what the core mission of the agency needs to be and whether it's built to serve that purpose. So that's one thing. Another is that there's some tension. I don't know if my colleagues would agree, but I think there's sort of ongoing tension between the political dynamics. WHO's governance is fundamentally political. Mm-hmm. It's, ministers of health.
Meeting right now.
Huh? Yes.
Meeting this week.
Yes. Yeah, meeting this week. Exactly. And the core technical mission of the institution. And I think there are ways to create the adequate firewall and independence to be able to fulfill that core technical mission. There are agencies that serve as models for that. But right now, it's not quite there. At least that's I will take that as my view. I don't think it's written down in the report.
Okay.
I think WHO has a very important role to play. As we say in the report, if it didn't exist, we would have to create it.
Right.
Because it really is the one place in which people can congregate around the world and talk about the health issues. WHO is immensely and enormously respected in countries worldwide and in the field. And I think we need to understand. The call that we have in the report for an assessment of WHO is also in the context of an assessment of the UN. The UN is undergoing a process of assessment, so this is not something that is not in the path. So it's part of the path, it's an important part of the path, and ensuring that it is as effective as it can be and should be is very important to all of us.
I actually want to bring the conversation to the issue of health systems and a little bit of back to the role of the U.S. We've got two questions about this in the last few minutes. One question I'll read, it's from Physicians for Human Rights. They ask, as we move towards a much-needed integrated approach to fighting disease, improving health, and strengthening health systems, what role, and this is about PEPFAR and health systems as well, what role do you think PEPFAR should play in our response to global health overall? and I'll make that specific to PEPFAR, but I'll expand it. So if you want to start talking about health systems, because we do have a few questions on that as well. So the role of PEPFAR, broadly speaking, in this integrated approach. Did that come up much in the committee? I would imagine it's about 70% of the funding right now.
Yeah, so I'll start and, you know, my colleagues can chime in. This is, you know, very active discussion in Washington and the field these days. The new PEPFAR reauthorization explicitly calls out health system strengthening as one of the missions of PEPFAR, but in some sense, I think we have to see it as secondary to and supportive of the core missions around sustaining scaled-up treatment, prevention, and care. I mean, PEPFAR, you know, it's going to fail if it focuses exclusively on system strengthening to the, you know, and doesn't continue to pay, you know, primary attention to its work in HIV/AIDS. So the way, as I understand it, the Office of the Global AIDS Coordinator is thinking about it is that there are direct benefits that PEPFAR resources can bring to health systems through its work on HIV/AIDS, whether that's strengthening laboratories or other investments that are made. There are some intentional spillovers to achieve broader health system benefits, and that might be through the training programs for health workers, for example, having the curriculum be about more than HIV/AIDS. And then there's an ability for PEPFAR, with the other global health dollars the U.S. spends, to leverage health system change. So one example of that might be when you, if you introduced performance incentives where either governments or districts were given rewards or bonuses for achieving particular health targets, make them about more than HIV/AIDS, make them about immunization, about attended deliveries, make them about achieving better quality and delivery of services. I don't know if others want to add there.
They're not a good model. There are not a lot of good historical models for that working and working effectively. Now, if you were to say to me the only way you're going to get systems in is to back it through the malaria program, the PEPFARs program, polio eradication, I'd say we'll take whatever we can get for systems. But the bottom line, and I would amend Ruth's comment to say, if you want these programs to succeed eventually, you need systems to get them done. That who's going to be providing this care? Are you going to do it in a vertical siloed way forever? Then until you get adequate primary care systems going in these places and population-based public health systems doing surveillance, disease investigation, evaluation activities, you're not going to have success in these programs. You may be able to drive a given time-limited program this way, like smallpox eradication was done. But for something that's going to go on over the long haul, I think it's very hard to sustain it, and it's very expensive to sustain it, doing one for each individual disease. Now, in some of them, you can expand what they do for surveillance or expand what they do for care because it's a natural setting to add something on. So you can add on family planning information with some maternal and child health work along with your whatever the infectious disease you're dealing with. But to me, it's still kind of a backwards way to do it. What about a strategic plan which starts and says, what are our biggest problems? How do we deal with them? How do we best deliver them? And how do all these pieces fit in? And I guess my goal would be to have the countries take ownership of this. And that, but when the aid givers, be they private or governmental, say that's the government's responsibility, we're not going to touch that, we're just going to do the vertical programs, that doesn't provide the support that those countries need to get those infrastructure systems built and put into place. And we just haven't been doing it. So regularly we visit places and we're working in places where, yes, labs are being built with high-tech delivery for diagnostic purposes, but they're geared towards one particular disease, one particular area, and it in many ways diverts the broader population-based activities that are going on. So I think we have to have some element of our portfolio, the balance piece again, which says systems. And it's not a very sexy term. It doesn't capture anyone's excitement the way malaria or whatever the disease you want does. But it's got to be there.
But there are other, I just want to say that there are, I completely agree. I also think that we have to recognize that there are others, other funders, maybe in a slightly better position politically to really be the heavy investors in systems, whether that's the UK Department for International Development, whether it's the World
Bank.
Whether it's the World Bank. I think, you know, it's within that context that we have to figure out, well, what's the U.S. role?
And also any systems, we had a tremendous amount of discussion about the importance of systems, unsexy as they would be, and whether it was our role or not our role. They are critical. They are sine qua non. We have to have them. And they have to be sustainable. Coming in, making an intervention, fixing something, and then leaving only to find that it is dismantled is just not the way to do it.
Just on that there, we're talking about systems broadly. There are multiple elements to the system. So one is the academic system of research and training that's in the U.S., which I think is superb. And I think our experience in that, we have things we can offer that as both a model and as a partnering. One of the things mentioned in the report is a partnering or a twinning relationship or a triangulation relationship between U.S. universities and universities overseas, where some of our strengths can mesh with theirs in creating a better product. I think we are in a weak position to advocate for our healthcare delivery system as a model for others, and we recognize that in the committee. But we're in a strong position for our public health system, which I think is a superb, even with its needs and even with its underfunding. Our county, state, city, federal public health framework is one that is remarkably effective, and the ability to nurture some of those elements in other countries, such as national public health institutes, which we have seen in play during this recent swine flu epidemic, I think is something we can do.
Believe it or not, we're almost out of time. So what I'm going to ask each of you to do, if you want to, is, okay, maybe there'll be another report in 10 years, not sure, but in the next 5 to 10 years, what would you like to see, or what were a couple highlights that you would say, okay, that is the direction we needed to go? What would be your big wins for the U.S. Going forward?
If we could have a national recognition of the importance of these issues and that they're part and parcel of who we are and what we need to do and our ability to take a leadership position on health, and that leadership position is going to give us very much quantifiable gains internationally. I think that would be something I would like to see.
Okay. Anybody else? I know it's hard to pick one thing. But think about Twitter. Think about your Twitter model.
I know. It is hard to pick one thing. I think what I'd like to see is if there is a kind of follow-up in 10 years and committee members travel to countries that have received a lot of support from the U.S., that they go and they see, as my colleagues were saying, stronger health systems in place, capable institutions and well-trained people, and very few American flags on vehicles or, you know, very few American personnel in place, that we've really contributed to the development process, not so much the kind of emergency relief process.
And I guess I would say kind of the same thing my two colleagues have just said, but do it when I'm visiting with colleagues in Bangladesh or Ethiopia or Uganda or Cambodia, wherever it might be, 5 or 6 years from now, I would love to have them say to me, look at the progress we've made in these things. We've done it in collaboration with this university or that association. We've done it with support from your country, which we appreciated. But now we're in a position to say, this is what we want to do, and this is how we're shaping it. And we're glad to hear your ideas. But we got some pretty good ones of our own. Thanks.
Okay, well, I agree. on that note, I'm going to end and thank all of you for being here. We could have gone on with this discussion, clearly, and we'll look on the blog posts and see if more things come out. But I want to also turn to our audience and thank you all for your questions. On our website, globalhealth.kff.org, you'll find additional resources on today's In Focus, and we encourage you to share the video and transcript with your audiences. We also hope that you will join us for future webcasts of U.S. Global Health Policy In Focus. I'm Jen Cates of the Kaiser Family Foundation. Thank you.